sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Ira Spar, discussing the 10 Lost Tribes of Israel. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Purim is here, the wonderful festival of fun, frolic, costumes, drinking, gambling, gamboling, and of hamantaschen, the most perfect food ever invented. Unless maybe it's latkes. For those of you unfamiliar with the festival of Purim, called by a very few people the Feast of Lots, Purim celebrates the events of the Book of Esther in the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible. That book, originally written on a scroll, a Megillah, known as Megillat Esther, or the Megillah, tells the original story of religious persecution against the Jews, an attempt at genocide by Haman, one of the first of the many evil villains who have tried to destroy us throughout the many millennia of Jewish history. Only Jews could make a fun festival out of attempted genocide. We do it this time because Haman's efforts to murder the Jews of the Persian Empire, essentially all Jews in the world 2,500 years ago, well, because it failed and we won. As that nine-word summary of all major Jewish festivals from Hanukkah to Passover each year goes, say it with me now, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. And on Purim we drink, too, and wear costumes, and sing, and revel, and generally have a great time. It's customary to cheer the heroes of the Purim story, Mordechai and Esther, and to boo the wicked Haman. As usual, the bad guy is the most interesting person in the story, but in this instance, he loses. The good guys and women win, and we rejoice. Now, about those hamantaschen. The pastry we enjoy on Purim is a cookie made with lots of butter, shaped into a triangle and filled with poppy seeds, or jam, or jelly, chocolate, Nutella, whatever you think will taste good. Frankly, all hamantaschen are delicious. We wash them down with our favorite serious beverage of choice. It's customary to bring them as gifts to friends, along with fruit, candies, and other tasty, unhealthy treats on Purim, called mishloach manot, or shalach monas. We want everybody to enjoy Purim. To play us in this morning, here's a fast Purim medley from Argentine Jewish singer Micha Gamerman for the wonderful festival of Purim.
Barashanim. Rasha shas, rasha shas. ויהי בימי אחשוורוש, ויהי בימי אחשוורוש, המולך מהודו ועד כוש, המולך מהודו ועד כוש, שבע ועשרים ומאי המדינה, שבע ועשרים ומאי המדינה. שבע ועשרים ומאי המדינה, שבע ועשרים ומאי המדינה. חייבים ניש לביסומי, 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 חייבים ניש לביסומי, לביסומי, לביסומי.
That was Micha Gamerman's high-speed Purim medley. Purim carnivals start today, while Purim begins tomorrow night with the Megillah reading, wild and raucous fun, costumes, and, of course, Hamantaschen. One of the great mysteries of history is what happened to the 10 tribes who made up the population of Israel, the Northern Kingdom, the so-called 10 lost tribes. Our guest this morning, Professor Ira Spar, is an archaeologist, historian, linguist, and expert on Assyria, Babylonia, and the whole ancient world. He'll answer the question of just what did happen to those 10 lost tribes when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates a wonderful array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. New progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 o'clock, followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall. We're not in the mall, on the south side, in our own building. Anyway, Purim arrives today and tomorrow night, a kids' carnival this morning, right after Too Jewish, and Beit Simcha's world-class Megillah reading raucous celebration Monday night, March 9th. Don't miss it. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and of course all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Iris Barr is a professor of history and ancient studies at Ramapo College of New Jersey, an expert on the Assyrian and Babylonian civilizations, on the ancient world in general, and a little bit on Israel as well. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Oh, good morning, Rabbi.
So I'm going to ask you about one of the favorite topics of all kinds of people, which is the question of the so-called 10 lost tribes. Maybe you can set us up a little bit and help us to understand what that means and maybe what happened to them.
Well, it's pretty simple on the surface that the Bible simply records that there were two states in Israel, the land of Israel. There was a state in the north called Israel. It was another state in the south called Judah. And if we look at the general geography of the area, we realize that Judah and Israel taken together were very, very small countries. And they didn't have really enough population to be able to withstand an onslaught from one of the major countries in the area. The big guerrillas were in Syria and were in Iraq. And if they decided either one of these major centers with armies that would deal with probably into the tens of thousands, if they decided they wanted to go to a rich area, which would be Egypt, Judah and Israel were in the way. And they had to be dealt with and slough them off to get to the riches of the Nile. So over several different centuries, but beginning basically at the end of the 8th century, the Assyrian armies came to the northern country of Israel. And in the year 722, they decimated Israel. Israel had tried to stop them with alliances with surrounding countries, with Arameans and others. And they were able to hold them off for short periods of time. But by 722, Israel fell.
And, you know, we should note that Assyria has often been called the world's first superpower. Do you agree with that assessment?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. It's very difficult to determine who is a superpower, given that we have really limited resources to understand the millennia that came before the rise of Assyria. Assyria in the first millennium was a great superpower, but they eventually fell to the Babylonians, who were a greater superpower,
right,
who eventually fell to the Persians.
To the Persians, who were another superpower, the better superpower, right? And then the Persians fell to Alexander the Great, and so on.
In the second millennium, you had other powers. Hammurabi of Babylon was an important power, and he had conquered into Iran, and he had conquered into areas surrounding himself and made alliances with all sorts of different cities. And before that, there were battles in the third millennium. So it's hard to really...
Hard to make that question. When we come back, we'll talk about what happened to the population of Israel, which was, after all, the larger and more populous of the two Jewish states that existed in that period after Assyria's conquest, and its long-term implications. When we return with our guest this morning, Iris Barr, here on Two Jewish. 10 Northwest Tucson congregations, including Congregation Beit Simcha, are sponsoring a multi-faith celebration of unity and prayer this coming Thursday, March 12th at 7 p.m. The event's free to people of all faiths. It'll be held at the Muslim Community Center of Tucson, 5100 North Kiwi Place in Tucson. Seating is from 6:15 to 6:45 p.m. The program begins at 7. The celebration is called Listen and Love, featuring an interactive program with music from a youth choir, prayers, and messages from leaders of each of the many faith groups, including me. Over 500 people attended last year. Join all people of goodwill this free multi-faith celebration of unity and prayer this Thursday night, March 12th at 7 o'clock, the Muslim Community Center, 5100 North Kiwi, K-E-V-Y. Bring a can of tuna for the community food bank, too. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail. or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from twojewishradio.com or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
All right, so a question I always ask you, where's your next trip?
All right, so my immediate next trip, we talked about quite recently. I'm just going with a few friends.
To Montenegro.
We'll be in Montenegro.
Okay, I'm sure you're not only going to Montenegro, you're stopping somewhere after that. But I'm
actually stopping somewhere before, but never mind. the next trip with any significant number of people in my sort of Jewish heritage tourism business is a trip that covers some wonderful cities with very different Jewish histories, but very important. And I would say, Jewishly, the most important of these cities is Odessa, which was a Russian city that didn't even exist in the 18th century. It was commissioned basically by Catherine the Great. It was designed by a Parisian city planner named Duriba, and it sprung to life almost full-fledged,
almost
as it
like
were.
Almost like a Potemkin city, except not Potemkin and real.
At the end of the 18th century. And by the end of the 19th century, 100 years later, it was the largest Yiddish-speaking metropolis in the world. Yiddish became the lingua franca.
The greatest Jewish press in the world probably at that time.
Right.
All kinds of fantastic things happening in Odessa.
And it was a very cosmopolitan place because it was a port with important links to all the Mediterranean ports and all the other ports in the Black Sea. It was the leading port of the Black Sea.
By the way, I have a friend from Odessa, and whenever I talk about, oh, it's brutally cold, you must be used to that, they always say, she always says, what are you talking about? I'm from Odessa. It's not cold there.
Right, it's subtropical.
Right, right.
And it's visually, it's a beautiful city, but there's this one street called the Street of the Jews, where pretty much every building has a plaque on it or a statue in front of it, whatever, to one of the guys for whom a street in Jerusalem is named. Chernyakhovsky, Jabotinsky, Shalom Aleichem, on and on. There was an unbelievable flourishing of Yiddish-speaking Jewish civilization and all the nascent forms of Zionism, all living in Odessa within like three or four blocks of each other.
Wow.
Between 1870 and 1900. And so it's an amazingly important place in terms of Jewish history. But even today, it has several functioning synagogues that span the gamut from ultra-Orthodox to ultra-progressive, liberal, whatever you want to call that, end of the spectrum. And there's at least one very good kosher restaurant in the basement of one of the synagogues. And there's a guy who has a private Jewish museum in his own apartment because the city didn't put one up itself. So we're going to go to Odessa. There's an optional pre-trip to Kiev for people who want to do sort of family roots research.
Which means Ukraine, anybody who has Ukrainian Jewish background.
Well, no, a lot of people come from within an hour or two of Odessa. So
right.
As a day trip, they can go and see and take pictures and come back. We're also going to Tbilisi, which has a unique Jewish history of its own, and it's the place where Jewish life and practice was least affected by Soviet rule for whatever reason, maybe because Stalin came from there, but the
Georgia, not American Georgia, but Russian Georgia.
Of course. Georgian Jews were left alone in the Soviet period, and they celebrated weddings and bar mitzvahs, and largely life continued almost as normal. Nonetheless, many emigrated to Israel, and there are a lot of direct flights these days. And Georgia, of course, produces the best red wines in the world and also has the best cuisine in the former Soviet Union. And then we're going to end up the trip at another Black Sea city, which is Istanbul, which has its own Jewish history.
Fantastic history. We've talked about Istanbul many times.
Much of it started in 1492 when the Jews were expelled from Spain, but
and invited in.
There were Jews there before and there were Jews thereafter and whatever.
There still are Jews, actually, in Istanbul. There's still a very active Jewish community
there.
Many,
and a great Jewish day school as well.
Sounds like a great trip, Tom, and I'm sure we'll talk about it both before and after. Thanks so much.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for the 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective. In a head-spinning week of Democratic presidential primary politics, the two leading Jewish candidates both took quite a fall. Mike Bloomberg, who spent hundreds of millions of dollars of his personal fortune building an organization and campaign, don't worry, he can afford it, saw his support on Super Tuesday overall end up around 12%, not nearly enough to provide any hope of gaining the nomination. He did win in American Samoa, of all places, making him only the second Jewish candidate to win a primary ever after Bernie Sanders. Speaking of the burn, Sanders was anointed frontrunner after strong showings in early caucuses and votes in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, and was widely predicted to be in the driver's seat for the nomination. That proved premature. Last week, two leading moderate Democrats, Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, both dropped out of the race and endorsed Biden. Joe Biden's campaign was viewed as teetering at best, but with those new endorsements, he surged to victory in 10 states, including major surprises in Massachusetts and Texas, while Sanders won just 4 states, including, however, California. Biden now leads Sanders in delegates, although both have only a quarter of what they'll ultimately need to be the nominee. Mike Bloomberg dropped out of the race after the votes were counted last week, pledging to support Joe Biden. While there's a long way to go, we are down to a two-person race. Elizabeth Warren also dropped out after Super Tuesday, and Joe Biden appears to have the inside track, at least for now. So maybe this won't be the year for a Jewish president to get elected after all. Again. That was our 2020 presidential election for Jews. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. America, my friends, has come a long way. It's now true that a president can sit in the Oval Office of the White House wearing a yarmulke and a tallis, provided, of course, that that president is not Jewish. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Boker Tov.
Boker Badet.
So, coronavirus is everywhere. Everybody's talking about it. And I guess there were a couple of Shin Shinim, just like you guys, who were in Milan, Italy. What was the story with them? What happened?
We have 3 Shin Shinim in Milan, Italy, but because it's been really spreading out, like mainly like over there, it's been increasing, and so they were brought back home, and there were some concern about the other Shin Shinim, like about us, if we should be brought back home.
Oh, from here.
Yeah, if it's to be a reason to worry. So they're brought back home. They're in Israel. Not that it's too safe in Israel now, but
right.
But they're back home, and there's been a few like talkings and just like rumors about maybe bringing us back. I don't know about that, but
they're concerned. There's definitely a concern. Yes. I would think. Obviously, there's no Shin Shinim in China or
no
Iran.
China.
In terms of countries.
Yeah. Good,
Yeah, it's possible, but unlikely. So there are some people who have been exposed to coronavirus in Israel. Is anybody actually ill with it, or just
yes,
people that are
there
exposed?
There are a few.
There are a few.
Yeah.
In the recent elections, there were some. Tell us about what happened, because the people that were there, some number of people have been quarantined within Israel, right? That means, is that basically house arrest? I mean, you stay there and you're sealed in your house. What did they do? But everybody in Israel votes. I mean, 70-some% of the population voted in this third election. Tell us about what they did for that.
So actually, they built a special kalpi. How do you say that?
I don't know. Polling?
Yeah, polling
places. Yeah.
Place.
Yeah.
And they sealed it from all around, and they called the 5,000 people that were in isolation in their home to come and vote, because this is their right, and they can't prevent that from them. So
so I assume they like come by wearing masks or something, or gloves. What do you do?
By ambulances.
Oh, by ambulances.
Yeah,
okay.
And so the people in the ambulance.
Trained personnel,
right.
With
of course.
Antiseptic or whatever it is they're using, right?
Yeah, something like that. And then they came inside the tent. It was like a tent or something. I don't know. And then they voted with the gloves. And they, after that, they washed their hands with alcohol. And it was really
pretty intense.
It was really funny and weird, but what can you do?
But they voted.
Yeah.
Just a kind of an aside, not so much about coronavirus, but when you guys voted, you actually flew to Los Angeles?
Los Angeles.
To the embassy there to vote?
Right.
So when Israelis, you don't have to be in the country to vote.
You have to have an Israeli emissary. So it's like putting like more in big city than big.
It has to be an embassy.
Exactly.
Before you can
an
do
Israeli
it,
embassy.
Right?
So it's, Jerusalem doesn't have
embassy,
one. Yeah.
Right.
So like LA, New York, Chicago,
Washington DC.
Yeah.
Right.
If you're like a tourist, you can't vote.
Yeah. You can't vote from Tucson, Arizona, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
Or you can go to LA and vote because you're not an emissary or something.
Right. Right. I see. So you have to have an official reason to be out of the country. And then you can vote. Well, it's great for participation, and I certainly hope that the coronavirus, which has affected the Middle East, but really much more in places like Iran, remains very limited in Israel. Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Ki Tisah, the story of the golden calf. While Moses is up on Mount Sinai carving the Ten Commandments in stone, or having God do it, the Israelites worry he's not coming back. They persuade his brother Aaron to make them an idol of gold, a calf, that they can call their new God. Pleased with the result, they worship it, then throw a big party, a bacchanal, a carnival, Mardi Gras in the Sinai. Coming down the mountain, Joshua and Moses hear noise from the camp below and are astonished. Joshua thinks that it's the sound of battle. But Moses knows what a good party sounds like. When Moses sees the cavorting and the chosen people worshiping a golden idol, he throws down the sacred stone tablets of the commandments, shattering them. The music and dancing suddenly stop. It's a shocking scene. For the rabbis, this is the most dramatic and distressing portion in the whole Torah. The problem's acute. According to the text of Torah, our people witnessed the divine power of the 10 plagues, were saved at the shore of the Sea of Reeds, received the great revelation at Sinai, in short, experienced God more directly than any other group in history, and immediately afterwards turned around and rejected God in order to worship a cow made out of their own jewelry. In Midrash, these events are called Maaseh HaEgel, the awful story of the calf. How can a people given a clear set of signs and wonders, commanded never to make or worship idols, only follow the true God for 40 days before pursuing a ridiculous bovine substitute? The answer lies not in our God, but in ourselves. We enjoy spectacle, are impressed by it, even awed by it, but as soon as it's gone, its effects linger a very short time indeed. What makes us tick as human beings, what keeps us in line, is the very dailiness of regular rules and schedules, the kinds of laws and rituals that are so much a part of practical Judaism. We need both ritual and structure, and until these are provided in a coherent way, we flounder, sometimes disastrously so, as in this tale of the golden calf. Without a way to connect to God regularly, without prayer services and a personal commitment to do mitzvot every day, we quickly lose our ability to be holy. Instead, we chase gold or idols or both. We become obsessed with our own pursuits, chase our own idols of gold. We need more than grand ideas or sweeping spirituality. We need religion and Jewish grounding in practice and experience, or we won't be able to remain ethical. Without that, we all begin to worship golden calves of every kind. It's a good warning for us today. Spirituality requires regular reinforcement, or we lose sight of our ideals and our hearts. May we find ways to seek God regularly and honestly this week. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Ira Spar, explores how Judaism actually developed in Iraq, Babylonia in those days, and we finally decide just exactly what did happen to those 10 lost tribes. All that when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The results of Israel's third national election for Knesset in less than a year are in. We know that Bibi Netanyahu's Likud gained several seats from the last election. Benny Gantz's Kahol Levon Blue-White Party lost a few seats, and yet again, nobody will be able to form a coalition to create a new government with official authority. The results were surprising and gratifying for Bibi, who is under indictment in three cases of corruption and expected to either lose seats or remain at the same level. Still, the most likely outcome remains that there will be a fourth national election for Knesset sometime in the next couple of months. This is not a Purim joke. Is it possible to have way too much democracy in a country? Keep in mind, there are 120 seats in Knesset. 61 votes are required to set up a government and choose the next prime minister. The electoral totals this time were Likud with 35 seats, Blue-White with 33, the Joint Arab List with 15 seats, Shas, the Sephardic Orthodox Party, with 7, United Torah Judaism, the Ashkenazic Orthodox Party, with 7, Labor, once the predominant party in Israel in combination of left-to-center parties Meretz and Gesher, with 7 seats, Yamina, the right-wing Zionist party, with 6 seats, and Yisrael Beitenu, Avigdor Lieberman's Russian Jewish party, with 7 seats. That means Netanyahu can assemble a right-of-center coalition with the religious parties of about 58 seats, 3 short of what's required for a majority, but that's it. Avigdor Lieberman remains a potential kingmaker, or at least a prime minister maker, but his insistence in the last election cycle that Likud and Blue-White form a national unity government, excluding religious parties from the ruling coalition, well, that led nowhere. Lieberman is now recommending that Israeli President Reuven Rivlin give Benny Gantz the first crack at building a coalition, which would be unusual and won't succeed. But neither will Bibi Netanyahu, since he needs 3 Knesset members to betray their parties right after they're elected and come over to his coalition in order to set up an official government. That won't happen. In the meantime, the criminal cases against Bibi continue. Israel, nonetheless, keeps on functioning pretty well without an official government, economically strong, innovative, productive. The main problem appears to be Israel's inability to make significant moves towards peace or settlement, or even more settlements, for that matter, with regard to the Palestinians, without a government that has any official mandate. Still, 4 national elections in a year? It does seem like a Purim joke, doesn't it? In coronavirus news, Israel's chief Ashkenazi rabbi asked Jews to stop kissing mezuzahs because of coronavirus, while a major European rabbinical group published its own directives to contain the spread of the illness. Rabbi David Lau last week said, "As we see the unfortunate spread of a terrible disease, certainly one shouldn't kiss mezuzahs or even touch them. Reflecting upon the verses written in the scroll, in our minds, will suffice." A mezuzah is, of course, the small parchment scroll with Shema and Ve'ahavta written on it that we Jews place in a case and affix to door frames. By custom, minhag, observant Jews touch and kiss a mezuzah on entering a home or building, although it's not technically required by halacha, Orthodox Jewish law. Also last week, the Conference of European Rabbis published a list of recommendations, including avoiding kissing mezuzahs, Torah scrolls, and other people to worshippers, about how to contain the spread of coronavirus. The group said anyone feeling unwell should avoid coming to synagogue. Everyone should avoid shaking hands if possible. They also advised readers to not panic and consider that wearing masks is much less important than washing hands, as the virus ability to travel airborne is very limited. About 3,200 people have died globally. About 100,000 have been diagnosed as having been infected, the vast majority in China, where the virus emerged late last year. Israel has also ordered all recent travelers to Italy, Germany, and France to enter self-quarantine. Only about 15 Israelis have tested positive for COVID-19. All cases have been traced to overseas sources of infection, with no fatalities reported yet. Still, Israel canceled all big Purim parades, along with any gatherings of more than 5,000 people, including sporting events. After last week's Tel Aviv Marathon barred foreign participants, this week's Jerusalem Marathon was canceled altogether. All international conferences in Israel are shut down, while Israelis returning from large international gatherings, no matter where they happened, were ordered into quarantine. Any Israelis who returned from any overseas trip was forbidden to attend gatherings of 100 people or more. Health workers are forbidden to travel overseas. Anyone over 60 or with a chronic illness, including diabetes and high blood pressure, has been told to avoid contact with anybody returning from overseas. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu encouraged people to greet each other with the Indian greeting Namaste, in which you hold your hands together and don't touch. Orthodox online sites have noted that religious Jews have been preparing for this their entire lives, since they don't touch members of the opposite sex. Several Jewish day schools in the New York area also closed out of concern for coronavirus last week. And AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, alerted the 18,000 people who went to its conference last week that a New York group in attendance had been in contact with somebody who has the virus. It's not clear where that group originated from in New York. Two Orthodox Jews from New Rochelle in suburban Westchester County have contracted the virus. To our knowledge, no one who attended the conference has tested positive for coronavirus at this time, AIPAC says. The District of Columbia Health Department considers the AIPAC conference to have been a low-risk exposure and advised recipients to consult with the CDC on preventing contracting the virus. Finally, our News of the Ridiculous department reports that a llama wearing a tuxedo and kippah attended an Orthodox wedding last week. I'm talking about the four-legged kind of llama, not the Dalai kind of llama. A Jewish man from Cleveland, Mendel Weinstock, brought a llama wearing a tuxedo and kippah to his sister Riva's wedding, following through on a five-year-old vow. He rented Shaki the llama from a llama farm, of course. Mendel told Riva 5 years ago when she wasn't dating that he would bring a llama to her wedding, just to tease her over how often she spoke about getting married. She tried to use reverse psychology on me and said, okay, the llama's invited to the wedding, he said. Riva then got engaged last October. He's been torturing me with this in good fun and reminding me of this probably twice a week for the last 5 years. I've tried striking so many deals. I tried doing literally everything possible to make sure it didn't happen, and lo and behold, there was a llama at my wedding. Mendel had a tuxedo and kippah specially made for his guest. By all accounts, the llama was very well behaved. No word on if it danced the hora or ate the flowers. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back our guest on Two Jewish, Professor Ira Spar, Professor of History and Ancient Studies at Ramapo College of New Jersey, an expert on Assyria and, well, the ancient world in general. We were talking earlier about Assyria's conquest of the northern kingdom of Israel, the capture and destruction of Samaria in 722. The Assyrians, when they conquered a people, sometimes did something that today we would call population transfer, ethnic cleansing. How would you characterize it?
Well, first of all, we have to deal with who was in the kingdom of Israel. And we call these people Israelites, and they should not be confused with a later term called the Jews, which really isn't introduced until hundreds of years later. So I prefer to talk about the exile of the Israelites from the northern kingdom of Israel and the Judeans from the southern kingdom of Judah. And they were forced to travel across the desert to get to Mesopotamia. And later on, the Syrians continued their march, and they came towards the country of Judah. And by about 20 years later, 704 to towards 700, the Assyrians started to attack the major cities of Judah, including Lachish and eventually Jerusalem. And when Lachish fell, we have pictures of it. There was actually scribes, artists, who were there recording the battles that took place and the destruction of Lachish. And we can see the Israelites, we can see the Judeans packing their bags, putting them on their backs, traveling across the road, being placed into POW camps. It's all inscribed on stone that were discovered in the 19th century and now in the British Museum. If you go online, you can actually see the pictures of the Israelites who were then forced to go.
Or you can go to London and see them in the British Museum, the greatest museum of kleptocratic civilization in history. But never mind that. Different subject. Go on.
And so the Assyrians were later destroyed by the Babylonians, and an even greater army came towards Jerusalem, and the country of Judah fell in 586, and the exiles were then thrown out. And again, the leadership was forced to move towards Mesopotamia. But the Bible gives us two conflicting versions of what really happened. One version is told in Chronicles and in Ezra that they were forced to leave. Another version is told in Ezekiel, where Ezekiel seems to say, yeah, the people were settled in the cities of Mesopotamia. And the archaeology now reveals that new finds show that there were actually places called, at least one place called Judah City, where the Judeans were exiled. And there they held prominent jobs. They were not just slaves the way the Bible would seem to indicate that many of them were. Instead, they were fully integrated into society. There were traders. They held land. And we have to view it actually from the Babylonian point of view. If you have a group of elite members of society who are well-educated, well-trained, well-read probably, who are coming to a foreign land, do you want to make them into slaves? Or do you want to set them up into an area where they could be servile, but continue their professions and pay taxes?
Yeah, build your economy and build your civilization. Right.
You know from Babylonian documents that there were outlying areas of agricultural land which needed to be farmed to increase the tax base. So we assume that these people, the Judeans and the Israelites, were placed into these outlying cities, and they were given sort of a servile status. Maybe they had to serve in the army, or they had to do some work in return for being given land. And then we know that they could also buy slaves, and they were prosperous. And we have the names of several hundred people, Judeans, with names that reflect God Yahweh. So that means that the Jews, the Judean population, were not servile to the extent that they were forced slavery, as were the Israelites in Egypt, but they were working on their own, making livings, being traders, going to the big cities. And this is reflected much later on in the Christian scriptures and, of course, in the Talmud. Where do we think that the Jewish communities of the Talmud came from, if not from the exiles?
Yeah,
and they were not slaves.
I've always thought that the 10 tribes who are carried off to Assyria, that there was some likelihood that they were reunited 140 or 50 years later, or maybe even less than that, 120 years later, when the Babylonians began to transport the Judahites, the Judeans, into really the same exact area or the same general civilization. Do you think that they were reunited at some point there?
Probably not. The text seemed to indicate that the Israelites were settled in the areas of Assyria, while the Babylonian exiles were settled in the area, let's just say Baghdad today.
Right.
They're really two different realms. They were two different countries. Those countries were really enemies of one another.
Although Babylonia had conquered Assyria by that point, correct?
By the end of the 7th century, Babylonia had conquered the Assyrians. That is correct. But that doesn't mean that they transported populations from the north to the south. But of course, there could have been traders. There was a lot of movement. One thing that we often forget when looking at the exile is that there was a reverse exile, that Israel, being located on the Mediterranean, was in an area that was well situated for trade with the Aegean, with Egypt, with Turkey, and all the surrounding islands of the Mediterranean. So this would be a good area for merchants from Assyria or Babylonia to travel to and set up their own merchant parts of the cities. And the Bible actually reflects that there were Assyrians who were living in the north in the country of Israel. And we have a document from at least the time of Cyrus later on, after the Persians had conquered the Babylonians, that there were traders who owned slaves who were living in the area someplace in probably of Judea, the old Judea. So there was one exodus, and then there was another re-entry of Babylonians, probably of good wealth, who came back to the area to live off the land and make money.
When the Babylonian Empire falls to the Persians, which happens not terribly long, I don't know, 45, 50 years after the destruction of the first temple and the permanent beginning of the so-called Babylonian exile. Well, it is a Babylonian exile, I guess. It doesn't take very long before the Jews are permitted to return. Who returns to Israel, really?
Well, we have only one document, and that's called the Cyrus Cylinder, which was discovered in the late 19th century.
Right. I mean, besides the literary record in the Bible, which is obviously not, you know, a contemporary document.
Well,
could be.
The Cyrus Edict is recorded in Chronicles, and it's recorded in Ezra.
Right.
And we have to think that those books were probably written sometime within the period of the exile.
Okay.
The Cyrus Cylinder indicates that after destruction by the Babylonians, Cyrus wanted to extend his empire in a way that wasn't to destroy what was there, but to increase his tax base. So he allowed people such as the Elamites and others from the northern area to return to their home cities, returned items that the Babylonians had stolen from their temples to them, and we assume that there were many such edicts, one of which recorded in the Bible, but is not recorded in Babylonian literature. And my idea is that there were parchments that were read out in all these different cities throughout the realm, indicating that people who wanted to go back could go back. And the Bible seems to indicate that it wasn't a mass return to the land, but it was a trickle that returned. And when these exiles did return, they weren't dealt with so nicely either. And that there was opposition to rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. So we can think about some of the elite returning back, but we also, from the cuneiform documents, can think that the majority of them probably were quite comfortable in their new cities, living in Judah City, in the outskirts of the Babylonian major capitals.
You know, it's probably no accident that the Babylonian Talmud is created, shockingly, in Babylonia. A lot of those Jews didn't come back, obviously, even though Israel again became the focus of Jewish settlement and civilization. I don't mean the Northern Kingdom, but I mean the whole of, I guess you'd call it Judea by then. What did the Persians call the province, and how did that evolve?
Oh, they called it Yehud. And the information about that is really
sketchy.
Meager.
Yeah.
Really don't have good, solid information about this period of time. We have some archaeological evidence, which is very, very interesting, in that within the land of Israel, there is a change in the type of artifacts that we find in excavations. That previous to that time, you would excavate, and I excavated in Israel for many years, and we would find these little idol figures. Sometimes they're called pillar idol figures. Sometimes they show nude women playing instruments. And they seem to disappear once we get into the Persian period of time, indicating that there was a change in the theology of Israel, and that probably this was the period of time when monotheism is really beginning. Prior to that time, there was worship of many different gods and the symbols of those gods as well. And that worship of a single god was part of a worship of many gods. That there wasn't a thing called exclusive monotheism until we get to the exilic period of time. And so the concept of the development of monotheism seems to be reinforced now by the archaeological evidence for the reduction, if not complete elimination in many cases, of these types of figurines that would represent other deities or spirits.
It's been said that the really first kind of pristine monotheism, or as you put it, exclusive monotheism, comes with Second Isaiah and the post-exilic prophets. What happened to those 10 tribes in Assyria? Did they just eventually assimilate into the general population?
They were not lost. They just assimilated, as you said, into the general population. And we can assume that some may have trickled back. But if you have a better life in a major city with a lot of money around, why would you go back to an impoverished land that had been destroyed? That doesn't make any sense.
And by the way, it was, you know, had been destroyed more than once, really. It was on, as you noted, it was kind of on the crossroads of empire. It was a perfect target for invasion.
When we excavated in the north around the Sea of Galilee, and we had an excavation in which we did five different sites at the same time. And we're dealing with tiny things, you know, a few acres in size. But when I was in Syria on an excavation, we're dealing with miles of sites. These were huge empires. Israel is really the backwaters of the lands of the Near East. If an Israelite city had 2,000, 3,000, that would have been considered something significant. If maybe Jerusalem and Lachish had maybe tens of thousands, maybe that amount, maybe even up to 20,000, some people think. How could it even compare to cities in Mesopotamia with 50 or more thousand people? The might and the power, the wealth of the Middle Eastern cities was far superior. And if you were making a comfortable living there, and you lived there for a long period of time, we find that when we look at the names of individuals, that when they arrive, often their names would include an element of God, of Yahweh. But after a generation or two or three, they just assume but local Babylonian names. And this is not just the case with Israelites or Judeans, but also with Egyptians and other West Semites. We can trace their families as they came to Mesopotamia. Originally, in the case of Egyptians or West Semites, as slaves working as gang laborers in temples or in work projects, and then we see what the names of their children were and the names of their grandchildren, and it's quite clear they just became local Babylonians or Assyrians within one or two generations. And yeah. I think that's what happened to our ancestors as well.
I want to thank Professor Ira Spar for a great visit here on Too Jewish for solving the question of the 10 quote-unquote lost tribes and noting, you know, this whole notion of population movement and refugees and migration is not exactly a new issue. It goes back to the deepest parts of antiquity. Thank you so much. Where can people go to find out more about you and about your work?
Well, they can go on metmuseum.com, and there is a section in the pull-down menu called the timeline, and I wrote many articles on that about Mesopotamian civilization. My books are rather difficult to read. They're really written for a specialist. However, I do have a young lady who's sitting right next to me who's making a video, a biography of my life and my work. And she hopes to show that sometime into the future. Just giving her a plug.
Looking forward to it. Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish with her about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be my father, Rabbi and cantor Baruch Kohan, discussing his career in Jewish Hollywood and his journey from TV to Torah. Our playout this morning is Israel's entry in the Eurovision contest for 2020 called Feker Libi, written by Doron Medali and Idan Reichel and sung in Amharic, English, Hebrew, and Arabic by 19-year-old Israeli star Eden Alin.
It's an infectious, upbeat tune appropriate for Purim, coming today at Purim carnivals, like at my own synagogue Beit Simcha this morning, and tomorrow night at riotous Purim Megillah reading celebrations. You know, like at Beit Simcha tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. Call 276-5675 for more information, or just come, in costume or not. My friends, have a true Chag Sameach, a wonderfully fun holiday of Purim, a Shavua Tov, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.